Welcome back to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. I'm your host, Bob Russell, joined as always by my co-host, fellow traveler, and partner in crime, John Jurisic. And as is always the case in our second hour, Lisa Helps, Victoria City Councilor and community activist, is sitting in with us as well. Always good to see you, Lisa.
Good morning.
Much nicer to see you than John.
Poor John. I think it's
but
nice
he's
to
right.
see John. Well, there we go.
Okay. Well, you know, we've been talking about education. The provincial government is undertaking a review of the K-12 curriculum in British Columbia. Today we're talking about the different ways education gets delivered in the province and with the people involved in doing that. Joining us on the line right now is Colette Beatty, Director of the British Columbia Home Learners Association. Welcome to the show, Colette.
Hi, thank you.
My first question would be, just explain to me, you know, what is the British Columbia Home Learners Association?
Okay, the BC Home Learners Association is a not-for-profit society. It was formed in 1987, and basically it was formed to represent home learners from basically all walks of life in BC. And we liaison with the government. We do public relations to the community and different agencies. And a big part of our reason for being is supporting and encouraging home learning families.
Good morning, Colette. John Jurisic. There's a sense from folks, at least that I interact with, how is there enough discipline within that environment that you're representing to meet curriculum objectives, to do the sort of work that happens in a school? How do you keep not that I'm challenging that there isn't, but how does that work for the listener? Lisa and I chatted just in the break. She gave me examples of how brilliantly that does happen in several of your instances. So could you sort of talk about that a little bit for us?
Sure. I guess the first thing to probably be clear on is that if you're a registered home learner with, in BC, you're not required to actually follow a curriculum or follow the BC curriculum that other students enrolled in schools in BC would follow. You are given the freedom to design your own curriculum and your own educational program for your child. So essentially, it could look, as different as every home learner there is out there. It really varies between families how each family approaches learning with their child.
And I think, sorry to interrupt, Claude, I think if I'm not mistaken, I have a very good friend who has a 9-year-old daughter whose life I'm very involved in. She's not gone to school. She dropped out of kindergarten, we like to say.
And rebel.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah. And part of, I think that, as you say, there are as many different ways to homeschool as there are homeschooling families, which I think is part of the magic of that approach to education. But one of the things that I appreciate, and curious to hear your thoughts on this, is that the extent to which, rather than discipline or imposition of curriculum, etc., that to do homeschooling in a particular kind of way, it's really a child-driven education. Can you say something about that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what it is because you're basically, one-on-one, or depending how many kids you have at home, it could be, one-on-three or four, but you have the opportunity to sort of work with your child and go at their pace, follow their interests. So, for instance, my son wasn't ready to read till he was 8, so he didn't read till he was 8, as a home learner, and that wasn't an issue, whereas in school it may have been a little tricky for him. And also, I know a lot of families, including myself, we take what interests a child mm-hmm. and we try and design education around certain interests so that they have a way of engaging in their learning a little more than maybe they would have otherwise. My son loves computers, so I have a UVic student come and work with him once a week, and, I don't know what to do because I don't understand it, but we have a lot of fun. he seems to be learning.
They're
a
playing
lot.
Games, Colette.
Yeah.
He's teasing you. He's teasing you.
I'm told they're doing work, but I can't be sure.
That point, I know Bob wants to jump in, but play is just a terrific way of learning.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. It's a great way. And also, too, it doesn't take a whole lot of... I'm probably one of the more, stricter home homeschooling mothers. You know, I do have my own curriculum that I've got that I like my kids to follow. However, it doesn't take long to get things accomplished in the day when you're working one-on-one or, you know, with one or two children at a time. It really takes maybe a couple hours if everyone's focused. And then the rest of the day, the child has to, you know, play with their friends, be outside in this beautiful weather, take other classes. There's lots of home learning classes around the city, companies and people that design their courses and their time to incorporate home learning kids during the daytime.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned, you know, you're not required to follow the provincial curriculum. Now, I can, you know, understand and appreciate how, you know, if you can let things be a little more child-driven, like you mentioned your son wasn't ready to read until he was eight, and if he'd been in the public system, that would have been a problem. But, you know, now it isn't. But, you know, at the other end of things, when you know, the child has finished their homeschooling, even though they may or may not have followed the provincial curriculum, are there certain standards that, you know, have to have been met that are measurable? I mean,
can they get a dogwood? For example?
And I was just going to say, can they get a dogwood, for example?
No. If a parent chooses to homeschool their child, like right through till, you know, they've decided that their home learning has ended and the child's maybe going on to other things in life, they've grown up, that, and they've been registered with the government as a home learning family, that child won't have a dogwood.
Okay.
They're not required to graduate. However, they won't, you know, be given a dogwood like other kids who are in school.
Okay.
So that's sort of the give and take of that situation.
So what happens when, you know, that child gets to an age when they want to, for example, maybe go to a college or a technical institute or a university? How do they gain admittance to post-secondary institutions?
Yeah, some universities and some post-secondary are quite progressive, you know, especially in the States more so, and in Ontario, they welcome home learners, you know, because they understand that most of them are pretty independent kids. They kind of know how to work on their own. Mm-hmm. But other times, it's you're sort of trailblazing a bit with some schools. Like a friend of mine, her two older boys who are now graduated from UVic, they got into UVic and did a four-year program without ever setting foot in a school or having a dogwood. And it just took a lot of effort on her part, a lot of talking with the school, a lot of meeting with the school, meeting with different professors. It was legwork, you know. It was kind of, you know, it's not your usual route. But it can be done, and it can be done easily with some schools and not at all with others. And it takes some work with some schools like UVic.
Colette, we're a large part of what we're trying to do here on the show is inform and educate. This is not meant to be a challenge.
No.
What sort of percentages of the of our K-12 our group of kids are homeschooled? We just spoke with the independent folks; they were up around 12%. And then is that skewed heavier in the early years, and then the kids themselves might choose to go to high school or something like that?
Yeah, I think that's the case. There's, you know, it seems to be a real the big balloon in homeschooling comes when they're little and sort of elementary towards middle school years, and then as high school comes along, you know, the kids sort of choose different paths for themselves sometimes.
Right.
But the number I have for 2010, which is the last one I can find, were 2,400 registered homeschoolers. That means people who have told the government that they're going to take charge of their child's education and, you know, no involvement from the government. However, there's another segment of what people call home learners, and that's kids who are in distance learning or distributed learning, mm-hmm. which means that they learn at home, but they're enrolled in a school or a distance school, and they follow the curriculum, and they do that at home with their parents.
Right.
And that's a much bigger number. That's, mm-hmm. I think, around 23,000 kids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure percentage-wise how that falls within, you know, the number of total number of school kids in BC, but those are the actual numbers of kids.
Mm-hmm. Colette, I wish we had more time, but we're going to have to end it there. I thank you very much for coming on the show and explaining the home learners. We're just going to break to commercial. When we come back, we'll keep talking about education.
From the CFAX 1070 Community Cruiser, here's what's happening.
The 6th Annual Vancouver Island Baby Fair is on Saturday, September 29th and Sunday, September 30th at Perks Rec Center. Visit the largest event dedicated to pregnancy, birth, babies, toddlers, preschoolers, parents, grandparents, and more. Come out for UVic's 50th anniversary celebration Friday and Saturday, September 28th and 29th on UVic's campus. The festival event schedule includes highlights such as Vic's athletic games, family zone, live music, campus open house events, barbecue, theme tours, and much more. CFAX Santa's Anonymous Society is fundraising for the Good Life Fitness Victoria Marathon. It's on Sunday, October 7th. Al Farabee is running the half. Go to our site to donate online now. If you want to find out more about these and other events, just go to our website. It's CFAX1070.com.
Watch for our Mini Cooper Clubman at local events. Sponsored by Mini Victoria and Windsor Plywood. From Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
A Makeson Fitzpatrick Insurance Community Update.
On October 25th, join us at the McPherson Playhouse for an electrifying double bill of Alex Kuba and Kuba Ohms, performing for Hope, Help, and Home. All funds raised go to Community Living Victoria in support of people with developmental disabilities. As a community partner, Makeson Fitzpatrick reminds you, tickets for this sensational night of music are on sale now at the Mac Box office.
At Makeson Fitzpatrick, our mission is to improve the lives of our clients, team, and community. To learn more, visit MakesonFitzpatrick.com.
The grand opening sale is in its final days at the all-new Dodds Furniture and Mattress location in Nanaimo and Dodds in Victoria.
Both stores are overflowing with furniture for every room in your home, so hurry in while the phenomenal specials last.
Plus, Dodds has Canada's largest Serta mattress gallery with over 40 beds to choose from.
With nothing down, no interest, and no payments for a full year, you'll save even more. The grand opening sale ends soon at Dodds Furniture and Mattress.
715 Finlayson across from Mayfair, and now in Nanaimo.
Captain Comfort here for Lansdowne Appliance. It's my job to ensure your family has all the comforts of home, starting with made-to-last Maytag appliances. Now through September 30th, shop Lansdowne's made-to-last event and save up to $1,300 in instant savings on qualifying Maytag appliances.
Visit LansdowneAppliance.com or see their downtown showroom at 2517 Douglas at Bay, and you'll be a money-saving, energy-saving
appliance superhero!
CFAX 1070 puts Victoria first with complete coverage of local news, weather, and traffic when you need to know. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Welcome back. You're listening to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. My name's Bob Russell. I'm joined in studio, as I always am, by John Jurisic and Lisa Helps. We're talking about education. The provincial government is undertaking a review of the K-12 curriculum. Today, we're talking about the different ways education gets delivered in the province and with people involved in doing that. Too often when discussing public issues in our province, we forget to include our First Nations. We won't be making that mistake on Sunday Morning Public Affairs. Joining us on the line right now is Tyrone McNeil, president of the First Nations Education Steering Committee. Welcome, Tyrone.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I'd like maybe just to start off, Tyrone, and it's going to be overly simplistic the way I'm going to do it, but I think when and this is for the benefit of our listeners. A lot of times when they start hearing, you know, about, you know, what's going on with First Nations or First Nations issues, how they affect First Nations, it becomes very complicated and hard for them to understand. So I just want to provide a little context, and I know this is the context can be complex, but, you know, just paint the picture that, you know, we have a federal system of government in this country, as such, you know, we have a federal government and we have provincial governments, and the government of Canada is actually not the federal government. The government in Ottawa, it is the federal and provincial governments, and their responsibilities are divided, some shared, some exclusive. And in their wisdom at the time, in 1867, our Fathers of Confederation, and I can hear you laughing, Tyrone, in their wisdom decided through Section 9124 of our Constitution to say that the federal government was responsible, and I am quoting here from our Constitution, Indians and lands reserved for Indians. And the way that has been understood and interpreted through time is that regarding our First Nations, that is exclusively and totally a federal responsibility, and nothing that provincial governments do has any effect on, impact, or benefit or service to First Nations. And we're talking about education, and education is an exclusive provincial jurisdiction. So the federal government was left, just like it was with health care and infrastructure and all sorts of things, to provide a service that it basically had no expertise at all to provide. Now, everyone's heard about the residential schools and the legacy of that. What a lot of people don't know is that, you know, while most of them closed in the 1970s, there were residential schools operating in this country as late as 1995. But they aren't anymore. So now what I'd really like to do, Tyrone, is sort of turn it over to you and say, okay, people have heard of residential schools. They don't exist anymore. You know, federal government is still presumably responsible for education. What's happened since the 1990s till now?
Maybe I'll start in such a way, John, that just to share with you and your audience that, you know, yes, the last residential school closed, but just given that whole system's taken entire generations of children away from their parents, purposely disconnecting that parental-child relationship, disconnecting the child from their language and their culture, their history, their knowledges, and in addition to that, purposely harming them physically, emotionally, as well. And if you do that over 5 to 7 generations that the residential school existed, the social issues that scenario creates doesn't disappear as soon as the last school is closed. Mm-hmm. So that's a reality for us. We're trying to amend and revitalize and re-strengthen our people through education, recognizing that there's some pretty significant and serious disconnects made by church and state over a large number of years.
Mm-hmm. So just going to say, you know, so what in fact, you know, from a delivery point of view, I mean, you know, how is education being delivered now?
Just before I respond to that directly, can I also add that in 1969, Canada introduced what they called the White Paper. Jean Chrétien, then Minister of Department of Indian Affairs, tabled a federal policy that would fully assimilate all Indians, their First Nations. Naturally, we rebelled. And now to bring this a little bit more focus to the topic of the day, one form of our rebellion was to create a national policy framework called Indian Control of Indian Education. Mm-hmm. And back in the day, it was fine for us to call ourselves Indians and for others to call us Indians. Mm-hmm. But that set a national framework that spoke to an education system under local control, local control by First Nations. It spoke about reinstilling identity and language and culture as a part of that education system. Mm-hmm. It spoke about parental involvement. Mm-hmm. It spoke about its relation between that local control, the provincial government, and the federal government. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, the federal government did accept that as a national framework. Mm-hmm. And that opened the door for us to take control of the existing schools in our communities. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the First Nations started operating a kindergarten program, kindergarten grade 1, kindergarten grade 2, pretty small schools.
Okay.
But over time, we built our capacity to be more involved in that control.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in that capacity of being involved, we're kind of in quasi-land when it comes to what are you asking for around provincial responsibilities and what are you asking for around federal responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
because we're not a public school, we're not a private school system, we're in between.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I guess what I'm trying to, you know, there's an infrastructure that is being developed, that you are developing, that you know, as I understand it, your organization, the First Nations Education Steering Committee, is responsible for developing to deliver education. Is that correct?
Somewhat.
Yeah. Somewhat.
we have two organizations, First Nations organizations involved here. One is the First Nations Schools Association.
Mm-hmm.
They're their own society, their own board that are responsible for the 130 schools on reserve in BC.
Okay.
We have a relationship, we being FNESC, has a relationship with the Schools Association that we provide all administrative function to the Schools Association.
Okay.
So when we say FNESC might be acting in terms of K-12 on reserve, it's actually FNESC in partnership with the Schools Association.
Okay, but so you would be sort of like the equivalent of a Ministry of Education.
Well, quite often we're viewed as that,
mm-hmm.
and sometimes as well we're viewed as school board or providing school board like services,
mm-hmm.
but we're not quite either. We're somewhere in the middle.
Good morning, Tyrone. Now that we've kind of cleared up to a certain extent what the function is of your organization and related organizations, one of the things that I'm really interested in is what kind of content are First Nations schools delivering, obviously math and English and all of those kinds of things, but particularly in response to the five or six generations of undoing of cultural and social ties that happened during the residential school era? What kind of culturally specific education are particularly the on-reserve schools delivering to address those things directly?
I can use my school here, mm-hmm. in Seward Island, Upper Fraser Valley, as an example. We're K-12. My language is Halkomelem. It's a part of the Coast Salish dialect, or language family, sorry. And for any child to come to our school, Halkomelem is mandatory.
Mm.
They don't have any choice.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll get language 3 to 5 times a week, depending which grade they're in. We have key times throughout the school calendar where there's ceremony, like formal ceremony, that the entire school, all the students participate in. There's all kinds of smaller, I shouldn't say smaller, other times in the year that are more class-based or grade-based.
Mm-hmm.
But it's entrenched right into the system. They're not pulled out of class to do any of this. It's a formal part of their education system.
You know what's interesting to me, and then I'll turn it over to Bob or John to jump in, is kind of the congruency between your comments and the comments of our last guest on home learning. In a sense, residential schools were the opposite of home learning. Children were forcibly removed from their homes and taken elsewhere. And it seems not that your schools are home learning schools, but there is a certain sense in which it's driven by cultural necessity and driven by cultural desire in the same way that a home learning kid wants to learn computers for 8 hours a day. So there's something really interesting about that to me.
Well, there might be a bit of a comparison like that, but we can't lose sight that what it is we're doing is based on our inherent right,
mm-hmm.
our Aboriginal rights that are recognized in Canada's Constitution, 1982.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about an approach, I think. The approaches are similar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the approaches are similar. That's exactly what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We just have to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Tyrone about First Nations education.
Your smile, it's your passport to the world. So if you could make your smile as dazzling as possible, wouldn't you? Today's Dental can help. From whitening and cosmetic restorations to preventative care for the whole family. From a very experienced team of dentists and hygienists, Today's Dental has everything your smile needs. Today's Dental, taking care of smiles for over 25 years. On Oak Bay Avenue near Oak Bay Junction, new patients always welcome. Call 382-5233 for an appointment or visit online at todaysdental.org.
Japanese food priced right. You want some? You'll find it at Osaka Sushi on Oak Bay Avenue. I'm talking miso soup Mondays, California roll Tuesdays, half-price appetizer Wednesdays, teriyaki beef and chicken roll Thursdays, sake and beer specials Fridays and Saturdays, and on Sundays, half-price tempura. 7 days, 7 specials. Osaka Sushi, the perfect place for a business lunch or a fun dinner. Just minutes from downtown, parking is free. Try Osaka Sushi on Oak Bay Avenue, one block shy of Val Bay Road.
It's time for more Speedy Tips from Speedy Auto's Mike and Kim.
Buying a car through private purchase can be risky business. The previous owner may not tell you or even know about potential problems with a vehicle. That's why Speedy offers full pre-purchase auto inspection.
Before you drop a pile of money buying a car, make sure you don't dump a pile more into repairs. For just $59.90, we'll do a thorough inspection and give you peace of mind before you buy.
Because it's Speedy, you're a somebody. Speedy Auto, 2992 Douglas Street, south of Mayfair, 385-8717.
Holy smokes!
CTV Tonight. The Primetime Emmys are back.
I really did win it!
It's TV's biggest bash.
Melissa McCarthy!
Wow! Sorry, I'm a crier.
Big stars.
Jim Parsons.
So odd for so many reasons.
Big surprises.
Are you kidding me?
Big moments everyone will be talking about. The Primetime Emmys. Tonight, live at 5 on CTV. Brought to you in part by Easy Breezy Beautiful CoverGirl.
I'm Elise from Thrifty Foods, and are you ready for some great fall savings in our flyer? New crop BC Gala apples, extra fancy, on for 99 cents per pound. Or family pack, saving size, sterling silver, top sirloin steaks, naturally aged 21 days and so tender you can cut it with a fork, only $4.99 per pound. And Ristorante or Casa de Mama pizza, assorted 325 to 450 grams at 3 for $9.99. Thrifty Foods, celebrating 35 years of smiles.
Thrifty Foods, smiles.
Whether it's snowmageddon, windpocalypse, or a boringly nice day, weather you can count on. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Welcome back to Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. My name is Bob Russell. I'm in the studio with John Jurisic and Lisa Helps, and we're talking to Tyrone McNeil about education. And Tyrone is president of the First Nations Education Steering Committee, which plays a big role in the delivery of education to our First Nations children in this province. Tyrone, let's maybe change gears a little bit here. You know, you mentioned that there are 130 on-reserve schools. There are also a lot of children who have to go off-reserve to get their education because, some reserves just, economies of scale can't have a school. And so they are accommodated how exactly by the public system?
It varies depending largely on the capacity of the community that they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those communities are lacking capacity, so they're basically sending their kids to the public school and paying the tuition, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Others with more capacity have formal arrangements called local education agreements between the community and the school district that lays out the expectations of the school district on behalf of our children attending their schools.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks to, in a formal way, influencing that public system in the schools in a way that better support our kids.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them speak to inclusion of language in those public schools, inclusion of cultural activities, inclusion of taking extreme care when placing our kids.
Mm-hmm.
We get quite prescriptive in that area because too often we're placed in because the system has such low expectations for our kids, they're rarely placed in the appropriate grade and grade level.
Okay.
So we're quite explicit in that area.
Okay.
And for a handful of us, it also speaks to the financial arrangement between the community and the district. Too often, we would pay the full tuition for our children attending public school, but they only go there for a month or 5 weeks.
Okay.
So some of our arrangements speak to paying the bill for the number of days our kids attend that school or that school district, just as a way to hold the system accountable.
Right.
Because too often, there's a thing called nominal roll.
Mm-hmm.
Once our child is placed in a nominal roll for a school in a school district, in years past, as soon as their name appeared, they get funding for the full year. So come October 4th, a number of our kids be encouraged to stop attending the school because it's not in their interest, it's not not worth their while. They're not going to succeed in a way, so just stay home.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a way of the schools kind of managing their class sizes. Mm-hmm. And that still continues today.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about, when your children go to a public school, they're interfacing with the provincial educational system. And let's talk a little bit about the role the provincial governments played. When I sort of was involved in government and related areas many years ago, many decades ago, the way that, and I worked in provincial government, not this one, another one, the way the province approached services to, on reserve First Nations was to say, well, if you send us a ban resolution and the federal government provides us with a financial guarantee, okay, we'll do it then. But if you don't do that, sorry, we're not going anywhere near it. I get the sense that now, particularly in education in this province, the provincial government has really come to the table, much more so than used to be the case, to lend its expertise in the educational area. Is that true?
They've definitely come to the table. I wouldn't necessarily call it lend their expertise.
Okay.
And I think that really starts describing the area and space that the FNEF occupies in that relation between First Nations and the provincial government.
Mm-hmm.
The provincial government has come a long way in recognizing First Nations need to be at the table to be a part of the planning decision making.
Mm-hmm. Tyrone, I have another question for you. Just going back again to content and relationship between reserve schools, off reserve schools. So to follow your example of the kid who starts school in September and by October the 4th or whatever the date you said was, decides this is no longer good for me, or the parents decide that, or whomever decides that, what happens to that child? So they go back to the reserve, there's no school. So how does that work?
It kind of depends where they are. Like my school here is about 10 minutes away from the public school.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got kids going back and forth, leaving the public system for our school, leaving our school for the public system for a whole gamut of reasons throughout the year. So, but in many ways it speaks to the student and parents' choice.
Mm-hmm. Would you characterize the relationship as flexible? Because it sounds, month at this school, month back at this school. How does that work for everybody?
No, not in that context. If they left the public system and came on reserve, it's for the year. They typically make one change a year.
Oh, okay. So it's not a back and forth.
No, that would be too problematic administratively.
Okay. Tyrone, just quickly back to the provincial government and the role it's playing. Okay, so it's more involved now than it used to be. My question would be sort of, well, why do you think that is? And my second question would be, what benefit are First Nations getting from that?
Let me put it this way. The provincial government has responsibility for education, as you read out, for our kids attending public schools. We've signed formal agreements, we being FNEF, signed formal agreements with the province that recognizes First Nations' role in basically a provincial realm and the necessity to do it.
Mm-hmm.
One example of that is that BC supported our First Nations jurisdiction over education on reserve. There's a provincial act to that effect. And in the development of that act, the province of BC formally recognized that we do have a system on reserve.
Mm-hmm.
We have solid curriculum. We have certified teachers, certified by the province, by the way. We've got excellent teacher supports. We have admin supports for principals and vice principals. And it's done in a way that when the province recognizes our system, it provides more opportunity for us to guide and influence their system.
So, again, a question that we asked an earlier guest, these kids go through K-12, and then where do they go next?
Depends on locality. For those that are closer to urban centers, they might be stepping into a college or university if they're actually prepared to do that. The majority of the kids will end up staying home for a year or working for a year and for those that want to go on to higher education, you have to take all kinds of upgrading programs. And also including those that graduate with a dogwood have to take upgrading to step into post-secondary. And that's where we're very similar with the general public, because we're told that the majority of the general public that graduate to the dogwood have to take upgrading before they can step into post-secondary studies.
Tyrone, I had to take upgrading after getting 3 university degrees.
He's opening up at Panzer. Tyrone, if we could talk, we had, I believe, the president or something of Independent School Association earlier on in our show.
The executive director.
Executive director, thank you. And he was talking about the almost explosive growth of online learning and online delivery. Talk to me, please, if you can, about the role of technology in delivering education to what I would suspect are some schools in not in entirely urban areas, and how that is working for you. I think you folks have a First Nations Technology Council. Is there a sufficient funding to help some of your more remote schools receive content via an online method?
But we are developing a distributed learning model based on that. But it's definitely a challenge. So many of our communities are so remote that the cost to get high-speed internet to them is extreme.
Absolutely.
So the short answer to the adequate resources is no.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But within that, we are making efforts to join students with teachers all across the province. See, one of our challenges is that we might have a grade 11 class of maybe only 4 or 5 kids in a remote community, and one of them wants to take biology.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they simply can't afford to bring that resource up to them, so we want to connect to them digitally. It's to leave their choices as open as possible.
Absolutely. It's actually one of the apparently, last I checked, one of the goals of a provincial government was to provide what they call these hybrid classrooms, mm-hmm. so that 2 or 3 folks in this community, 2 or 3 kids over here, 1 over here, could all then together form enough students for a teacher to warrant a teacher delivering that education. That is a role. This idea of high-speed connectivity is a place where the provincial government could play a role, mm-hmm. or somebody could,
yeah.
because it would...
We just had a meeting with the new Minister McRae earlier this week. And that's one of the things that we've put on the table with him. The province has the provincial learning network.
Right, right.
It's got a pretty solid backbone. And in, at least in some cases, that backbone runs right by or through our communities. So we want to explore is how can we tag into that, or mm-hmm. how can we come to some arrangement that our kids benefit in the end.
Mm-hmm. Tyrone, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I thank you for coming on the show. You have quite a big challenge and task ahead of you, and thank you for taking it on. And when we come back after commercial break, we're going to talk about a little more politics.
Are you having problems with paparazzi? Do you have deer eating away your gardens? Maybe you just want to spruce up your driveway entrance. Harbor Door installs a full line of driveway gates and entry systems. Automated gates are custom designed and unique to your property, adding attractive architectural detail, privacy, and security. Harbor Door has been installing gate systems for over 25 years and has the expertise to coordinate all the details from start to finish. For all your garage door or gate needs, call Harbor Door or visit online at harbordoor.com.
Hello?
You don't know me, but I know your husband.
What?
He's been doing things you might find, frankly, a little upsetting.
Excuse me?
He's been throwing his juice cartons in the trash.
But Mike would never do that.
Yeah, he did. And I'm sorry to tell you. Just keep an eye on him.
Who is this?
Call me O.J. Carton.
Every juice carton you don't recycle says something about you. Return it. It's worth it.
How Bell makes today better.
Let's go to the Bell inbox. Scott from Vancouver writes, I talk to friends all across Canada. What can I do to get my long-distance charges down? Well, Scott, the days of paying for long-distance in Canada are over. With Bell Mobility's most popular plans, all calls across Canada are now local. Bell is offering everyone in BC no long-distance charges with activation on a 3-year term.
Hurry, offer valid for a limited time. Bell, staying in touch just got better.
For details, visit the Bell store at the Bay Center. Bolin Books Hillside Center is Victoria's community bookstore, bringing you the best books from around the world for more than 35 years. This week at Bolin Books,
Sweet Tooth by Ian McEwan. It's 1972 and Britain faces its fifth state of emergency. The Cold War has entered a declining phase, but the fight goes on, and MI5 hesitates at little to influence hearts and minds.
Bolin Books, Victoria's community bookstore in Hillside Center. Call the Bolin Book line at 595-READ.
Shop, spin, and win with Save-On Foods for a chance to win a Caribbean cruise for four and more great prizes. Plus, get assorted Smucker's Pure Jam or Adam's Peanut Butter, card price two for $7. Or assorted varieties of Campbell's Chunky Soups, card price five for $10. Visit Save-On Foods and shopandspin.com for complete details. Save-On Foods, BC's very own since 1915.
Welcome back. We're in the last segment of Sunday Morning Public Affairs on CFAX 1070, Victoria's News Authority. I'm in the studio with John Jurisic and Lisa Helps, and my name is Bob Russell. And we're going to spend the last portion of our show returning back to politics. A rather interesting announcement this past week by Andrew Weaver, well-known UVic scientist, environmentalist, that he is going to seek the Green Party nomination in Oak Bay for the next provincial election. And I wanted to get Lisa's opinion of that. Lisa's green, okay? I mean, you don't get greener than Lisa. I mean, a lot of people talk the talk, and God knows, you know, 90% of the people you talk to about the environment are just talking the talk. Lisa actually walks the walk. What do you think about this, Lisa?
I think it's very, very interesting and a very, very significant step for the Green Party of British Columbia. I was tuning in to your show earlier from 8 o'clock onwards, and you addressed this a little bit in the first half, and John made a comment that this was going to, that the Liberals were cheering because this was going to maybe divide the left or that segment. What's very, very interesting to me are two things. One is that the Green Party in their press release describe Andrew Weaver as a fiscal conservative. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And I found out on Twitter this morning that he campaigned for the Liberals.
Absolutely.
In 2009. So I think I'm really, really curious to see if there is indeed that split of the left, NDP, or Green. Yeah. I think that the Green Party is neither left nor right. I think the Green Party is heading into another direction entirely that blends very strong fiscal conservatism.
It has always been a myth about the Green movement.
Yeah.
That it doesn't cut across party lines. Mm-hmm. It does.
It does.
I mean, people remember David Orchard? I mean, you couldn't get more right wing than David Orchard. And what was his whole reason for existing? The environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and held a, you know, the conservative, well, then the progressive conservative party of Canada to ransom during a leadership race. I mean, and Elizabeth May started her career in public affairs as a researcher for the Progressive Conservative Party when Brian Mulroney was prime minister. I mean, it's always cut across. John, you're chomping at the bit to get in on
no,
this.
No, this is an exciting one.
Okay.
Because I think it's reflecting something bigger than green. It's reflecting something bigger than what that name generally represents to people. Of the numerous comments that Van Dongen made within the last 48 hours, the conservative MLA who quit, he indicated that he would like to work within not the existing two parties, but within a new party, within a new sense of a political accountability.
And purpose.
And it's interesting that I think that is starting to manifest itself in folks like Andrew Weaver and Lisa Helps. Mm-hmm. And at some point a marketing person might even address the issue of brand. I don't necessarily think that it's a green party as much as it's a new party mm-hmm. or the people's party. Mm-hmm. And to that degree, I think Andrew, if he speaks that language and if Lisa continues to talk that language, mm-hmm. that we're going to start to see a new set of principles of a new generation. And that's why I think Andrew has a chance to win that seat.
Well, I would say you, not only does he have a chance, I'll say right now he's going to win. And he's going to win for the following
reasons. You heard it here on Sunday Morning
Public Affairs. Well, but he's going to win for the following reasons. What you've just been pointing out, John, that people are looking for an alternative. The existing political parties, I won't get all political science-y here, but they've failed at performing their function, which is to be organic beings that reflect their communities and give leadership and leaders and people in those communities an opportunity to have an effect on and lead the broader community. I mean, they're no longer performing that. They're looking for an outlet. I mean, this is reflected in everything from, voter turnout and everything else. And I'm sorry, again, internet voting isn't going to change that. If you want more people to vote, give them something to vote for. But, so there's that piece of it. Another piece of it is that, there's a pretty significant overlap here with Elizabeth May's federal constituency, mm-hmm. Saanich Gulf Islands, and that overlap is Gordon Head.
Yeah.
And I didn't have a chance to go and actually look at the poll-by-poll, information regarding the last federal election and in Gordon Head. But I'm fairly confident that if I did go and look at it, I would say that Ms. May did very, very well in Gordon Head. There's another reason. Two, why he's going to win. I mean, this is our favorite son. I mean, this is a guy who went to Oak Bay High, went to UVic, and there's that, Nobel Peace Prize thingy. That's kind of, that kind of helps a little bit. But here's the last reason why he's going to win. I see. I have this. The last reason why he's going to win is because the media are going to elect him. And the media are going to elect him because it's going to be a boring election campaign. Because they're going to go into it, and it's like, okay, there are not a lot of stories here. The story's old. Liberals are probably going to lose. It's a little closer. But, it's not going to be a dogfight. So what the media does in situations like that is they go look for interesting local campaigns to focus on and do features on. And you can expect that Andrew Weaver is going to show up in a lot of media reports, not just in this city, but province-wide, and probably, I would say right now, it will be his campaign will be a focus of a story that is done nationally.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The other reason that, let's call it, the other reason that I would agree with you that I think he's going to win is because Elizabeth May ran an incredible campaign.
Yes.
And she will, and her people, I'm sure, will lend their support to this campaign in a way that's appropriate. And that will not be insignificant. The other thing is that for the one MP in Parliament who is one member of the Green Party, she went all out against that budget bill in every way she could and took a real stand. And I think, there was some serious dissatisfaction, not necessarily about the content of some of the things that the Harper government was putting forward, although there was some dissatisfaction with content, but from all spectrums, there was a real sense that this is not democratic to push all of these things in as budget items. And Elizabeth May took a very strong and very articulate stand against that. And I think that kind of thing starts to shift the Green Party away from just green to green plus, if you will. And I think that Andrew Weaver can really capitalize on that.
Just go back to your comment about the type of campaign she ran. She ran an amazing ground game. And I mean, I was among the skeptics, and I said on radio, on the predecessor of this show many times, that she didn't have a snowball's chance of winning in that constituency, and she proved me wrong. Now, I want to change gears for a second, if we can. Lisa, you've been taking a few hits the last week.
Yep.
And it's regarding our mayor's plans on a trade mission to China, and you questioning whether or not that is an appropriate expenditure of public money.
Yeah, I it's interesting. I didn't realize that the letter that I wrote to the editor would create such a kerfuffle, but I'm glad that it has, because it's created for me, or created rather in the public realm, a really interesting dialogue. And I think what we're seeing in that dialogue, both official responses and the newspaper posts on Facebook and things that are happening at meetings or around dinner tables, is what is the vision? What is the 30-year vision for how we build a sustainable, resilient local economy? And there are, I agree that we live in a global world and we need to attract trade dollars and investment from elsewhere. I would wager that at this historical moment, when we're saying we need to, for the city of Victoria, cut $6 million in spending over the next 3 years, we said this year, no bus shelters, no park benches. We're nickel and diming for, you know, very important pieces of infrastructure. And the mayor is going to China in the same year. I think that we need to attract international investment. I just don't think that now's the right time for the mayor to hop on a plane and go and get more tour buses to come to Bouchard Gardens.
Well, Lisa, I tell you, we're really in my comfort zone here. As chamber chair in 2009, as initial chair and one of the founders of the Greater Victoria Development Agency.
An amazing body.
Correct. The GVDA?
Yes.
I couldn't help it.
I was just going to point out, John.
Okay.
She was talking about the GVDA.
Yeah. And, as board member on the BC Chamber of Commerce, I have been around the block on these trade missions, and I've been on almost half a dozen, maybe more. I am seriously challenged about why the City of Victoria thinks it's worthwhile going to China to generate business, when that equivalent amount of money could be put right into our community. I love the trade. I love the trade mission to Upper Fort that you're talking about. Love. How about Cook Street? I've been on these things, and I tell you, the folks who really benefit are the educational institutions. They get great mileage out of these things. Great. Mm-hmm. UVic, Camosun, Royal Roads, fantastic. Mm-hmm. But they're a different entity. Camosun College's two campuses are sitting in Saanich. Uh-huh. So why doesn't Frank go to China?
Exactly. No, seriously, that would be appropriate. If Frank Leonard goes to China on behalf of
really, municipally, is that where a mayor and a city council's monies are going to be spent productively towards economic development?
Folks,
Well,
we'd love to talk about this more, but unfortunately, we've run out of time. I want to thank all our guests today and Lisa. As always, a pleasure to see you. John, as always. And, of course, our producer, the digitally dexterous TJ Mullen. We could not do this without him. Thank you, TJ. I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in and wish them a happy Sunday.